Well, let's open our Bibles this morning. If you have a Bible with you, some fashion, form, Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11. We were off last Sunday, and so this morning we resume our stroll through this hall of faith, as we've called it, gazing at Old Testament believers who live by faith in the power and promise of God. And remember now, we are looking at them not to admire them, but to imitate their faith. Their persevering faith in the promise of God. That's why Hebrews 11 is here, to encourage us to imitate this kind of persevering faith. Their faith here in Hebrews 11 is displayed in their actions. If actions speak louder than words, we have a whole chapter of what faith looks like, how it acts, what it does. By faith, they did. He'll use that phrase 18 times, by faith. But their actions vary greatly. They're not all the same. We see different nuances in their actions that we are to learn from, but they all have in common this faith that we saw in verse 1 as he defined it, and things hoped for and things not seen. Their lives that we are to imitate demonstrate and are evidence of the reality of God and the certainty of his promises. That's what we see. Now, without a doubt, the two central figures of the Old Testament, especially the first half, are Abraham and Moses. So it's not surprising that our author here, after giving some examples from primeval history before the flood, up until the flood, that he structures the heart of his count around Abraham and Moses. So just note with me just a little bit here the structure of Hebrews 11, verses 8 through 31, which is the heart of it. As I said, at the beginning, he gives some examples from creation up through the flood, up to Noah. But then starting in verse 8, it's Abraham. And this main section, so here's the structure here. Abraham and the patriarchs, verses 8 through 22. And in that accounting of Abraham and the patriarchs, there's seven statements of faith altogether, by faith. Four statements of faith pertain directly to Abraham, followed by three of subsequent generations. That's what we saw last time we were in Hebrews, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. So seven statements of by faith. Four related directly to Abraham, three of those subsequent generations. The second part of this structure is what we come to this morning, Moses and the generation of the conquest, verses 23 through 31, and the same structure. Seven statements of faith, by faith. Four of those statements pertain directly to Moses, followed by three following Moses until the conquest. He's going to talk about the people of Israel's exodus, the fall of Jericho, and Rahab. Now, each of those sections, it's the fourth by faith statement, the fourth one related to Abraham, the fourth one related to Moses, that is the climax of their example. So I just note that structure just to show again how very carefully and deliberately our author has structured this Hebrews 11. He's not just including every example he could, and he's not including every detail about those he does include. He is very selective, very deliberate, very purposeful. He wants to illustrate the faith that he defined in verse 1, that we are to imitate. So that's what he's doing. So this morning, I'm going to pick up this next part, starting with Moses. We've seen Abraham and the patriarchs, and now Moses through the conquest. And as we pick this up, remember, it's a new era in the history of God's people. Abraham's descendants have become a great people. We saw the promise of that in the patriarchs, starting from the one Isaac. They have now become a great people. And so now the emphasis here on Moses and following is on identifying with the people of God in the face of opposition. So a slightly different emphasis than what we saw with the patriarchs, living as strangers and sojourners. Now identifying with the people of God in the face of opposition. Courageous perseverance of faith in the face of opposition. And again, all of these examples are serving the author's greater purpose in this letter. He's encouraging these saints, these believers who are in danger for various reasons of turning away from Christ, he's encouraging them to persevere, to hold fast. And these examples are serving that purpose. So let's read, starting in Hebrews 11. I'm going to read Hebrews 11, 23 through 28. I want to read all four examples of faith that relate directly to Moses. We'll look at the first two of those this morning, and then, Lord willing, the second two next Sunday. Hebrews 11, starting in verse 23 through 28. I'll read. You can follow in your Bible or on the screen. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn might not touch them. We'll stop there. Faith in the face of opposition. So last time in Hebrews we saw faith in the face of death, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, that was the emphasis there, but now faith in the face of opposition. And these first two examples from the life of Moses have this very theme. So we want to look at just each of these examples. There's just two we'll look at this morning, these two by faith statements, and see this theme. So first example, number one, the hiding of Moses, a fearless faith. The hiding of Moses. Verse 23, interesting. While Moses is the subject of the sentence, by faith Moses, and we're expecting something Moses did, but not quite yet. While he's the subject of the sentence, the verb is passive. By faith Moses was hidden. The faith is the faith of his parents, his mom and dad. That's the faith that's on display here. He starts here because you really can't tell the story of Moses without talking about his beginning and God's providence, this unusual beginning of this unusual character in the Bible. So the beginning of the story of Moses begins with the faith of his parents in a rather dramatic way. So let's note just a couple things under this hiding of Moses and his parents' faith. First, Moses' parents saw by faith God's purpose and trusted his unseen power and promise. Moses' parents saw by faith God's purpose and trusted his unseen power and promise. What's going on here in their hiding their son is more than just parental affection. Oh, it certainly includes that, but it's more than that. It's an act of faith. That's the point. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden. So it's more than just the natural parental affection, includes that. That natural parental affection, we would hope that that parental instinct would preserve life. But that's not always the case. We know that in our culture and in the history of the world. So there's more going on here than just parental affection. There is an act of faith. That's what our writer is highlighting. Why did they hide the child? So look at the text now. Verse 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. We'll come back to that. That's their action. That's what they did. Because they saw he was a beautiful child. What does that mean? That's a rather enigmatic statement. And we can read that, and it sounds a little superficial. Like, I'm so glad Moses wasn't an ugly child. Right? What would have happened? I think there's got to be more going on than that here. Now, our writer is simply quoting Exodus 2:2. He's not explaining, he's just giving the land. That's exactly what it says in Exodus 2:2, that they saw that he was a beautiful child. And that's what the phrase means, that there was something unusual about his countenance, some unusual beauty about his countenance. But what are they seeing? We don't exactly know how this worked, but it seems that they're seeing Moses and something unusual there in his countenance is what causes them, I think, to consider God's providence of a child for them, this beautiful child, at this time. Now, remember the context, and that's all important, back in Exodus chapter 1 and 2. Remember, the context is in Egypt. If you don't know that story, there's a new Pharaoh who doesn't know Joseph. He's on the throne many years later. He's afraid of the people of Israel because they're multiplying, and so he enslaves them with harsh treatment. That doesn't work. They keep multiplying all the more. So he tells the midwives, when Hebrew male children are born, you're to kill them. They refuse. And so then he issues this all-out edict saying, okay, every male child that is born is to be cast into the Nile and drowned. And I think he's just commanding not just parents, but I think he's going to enforce this. Officials are going to enforce this. Can you imagine parents living under that? How quick would you be to have children with that edict in place? They have a child. You see this? This faith? In that time, in that circumstance, they are choosing to have a child. Now, they're not in control whether it be a son or a daughter, but when they see it's a son and his beautiful countenance, I think it just compels them, reminds them of God's purpose and his promise. Either they are anticipating God's deliverance. Now, I don't think they've been given any special revelation about Moses. Jewish tradition has that. We don't have that anywhere in the text. But they are certainly hoping for deliverance, aren't they? They learned that from Joseph. Remember, we saw that last time. Joseph said, when God comes to visit you and removes you, take my bones with you. So they have this promise. They know. But they also know that children are a gift from the Lord. Maybe it's his beautiful countenance. It just reminds them again. I hope to every parent it does that. Reminds that this is God's gift, a gift from the Lord, and maybe part of his plan. I don't know. But something compels them to say, we will preserve this child and its faith. So they're trusting God's provision for them and God's promise to them and God's command to be fruitful and multiply, even in this very tenuous situation? I think that's their faith here. So like the Hebrew midwives that were just in the chapter before this one in the book of Exodus, remember, they refused to obey the king's command there because they feared God. Killing children is wrong because they're gifts from the Lord. They're made in the image and likeness of God. So we don't know. I wish we knew more about that little cryptic phrase they saw, but something in them is drawing them to God's purpose, to God's promise, to God's provision of a son. Either way, the writer says, it's an act of faith in the power and promise of God in spite of the king's edict. So note, secondly, this is the main point he's drawing. Moses' parents did not give in to fear, but by faith were courageous in the face of opposition. Moses' parents did not give in to fear, but by faith were courageous in the face of opposition. The last phrase there, I think this is the key takeaway that he's getting about the nature of their faith. They saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Wow. They were not afraid of the king's edict. This is the courage of their faith. I think he means there, they're not afraid for themselves. Defying Pharaoh's command? You don't defy Pharaoh. That's dangerous, if not deadly. And so they're taking no thought for themselves, risking this act of love to preserve their child in the way that they know how. Do you hear that? That's their faith. That's the faith, again, he wants us to imitate, because there's going to be opposition. These readers are facing opposition at various levels, and he's just encouraging this kind of fearlessness. Don't worry about what happens to yourself. Trust the promise and power of God, is what he's saying, even in the face of opposition and government edicts. Notice also, though, that this courageous faith that they had, they acted prudently, right? What is the action of their faith? They hid the baby, Moses, for 3 months. They hid him for 3 months. Can you imagine how intense, how stressful those 3 months were? Right, because I take it that neighbors turn you in or government officials. So you've got to keep a newborn hidden, quiet, unnoticed for 3 months. That is, until they can't anymore. And so they're doing what they think is right to do by their faith. They're not fearing the king's edict for themselves, but they're prudent in their hiding of the child. Can you imagine that? Now, someone I know might ask, wait a minute, isn't hiding the child an act of fear? Isn't that a lack of courage? I mean, if you aren't afraid of the king's edict, why'd you say, see, we have a son, what are you going to do? That's folly. This is wisdom. We're not afraid of the king. We're putting our lives at risk, but we're taking what's prudent here to hide the child. Right? You see the interplay here of their fearless faith and wisdom. So let me just, before we press on next example, just two lessons here from this first example, faith in the face of this opposition. First, trust in the promise and power of God frees us from fear and enables risk-taking love. That's what you see here. Trust in the promise and power of God frees us from fear, all kinds of fears, and enables risk-taking love. So again, remember the context of the book of Hebrews, who he's writing to. He's writing to those who have previously faced pretty intense opposition. They have suffered for it. It seems that opposition is either on the horizon, and they're fearing it. And so he's giving these examples. They're in danger, remember, of turning away from Christ. And maybe one of those reasons for their turning away is opposition. It's not popular. And so he's giving this example of this faith that's clinging to the promise of God and the power of God. It frees us from fear, and it enables us to take risk-taking love, actions of love. Now, there are times when we must defy governing authorities. Right? We thought a lot about this in the book of Romans 13. There are times. You see it here, both the Hebrew midwives and the parents here. There are times we must defy government authorities. When the government or authority commands what God forbids, like they're doing, kill your children, or forbids what God commands, yes, we must defy. Our persecuted brothers and sisters face this all the time. Remember them. They face these kind of decisions almost daily when either the government is opposed to their gospel proclamation or their meeting as a church or the culture is opposed to them. They have to make these decisions. As the apostles did, do we obey God or man? And here they had a freedom from fear of what would happen to them as they sought to obey God. Now, in our culture, we don't face a lot of that, perhaps more of it than we used to. Brace yourself, Christian, for that. Christianity is not popular as it has been. So be prepared. May this book prepare us for that. But we face lesser fears, I think. Fear of future, fear of the loss of our health, the fear of man in so many ways, whether we will identify with Jesus or speak of Jesus, the fear of death. And again, it's faith in the promise of God that frees us. Remember, we learned in chapter 2 that Christ came to set us free from this fear that enslaves us, the fear of death that enslaves us. Christ has set us free from fear. And that being set free is what enables risk-taking love. It's what makes you do things that might look silly to the culture or stupid. Putting your children at risk, or doing things that aren't for your immediate benefit, right? It frees from the pursuit of security, from the pursuit of comfort or convenience. It frees us sacrificial, to show sacrificial love. So there's the lesson. Just note, secondly, this isn't the main thing, but I'm just going to state it to you. You can think about the application of this. Courageous faith acts prudently in the face of opposition, yet without ultimate fear. Courageous faith acts prudently, wisely, in the face of opposition, yet without ultimate fear. They hid the child for 3 months. That, in their wisdom, the way they're thinking this out, that's what we should do. That's what faith is telling us to do. That's not cowardice. That's prudence. It's not from a position of fear, because it says they didn't fear the king's edict, but they are using wisdom. So our persecuted brothers and sisters will meet secretly when the government says you can't meet. That's prudence. They will share the gospel discreetly when the government says there's no evangelism. So many ways you can think means to use. Sometimes you flee persecution. We're going to read next time in verse 27 about Moses. He left Egypt. He fled from Pharaoh. Not out of fear, but prudence here. So I won't belabor this point. That's the minor point of the text. There's so many ways that we could think to apply this. I always think of the example of David. You know, David's the one who wrote Psalms like Psalm 56 or Psalm 27. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the light in my salvation. Whom shall I fear? What can man do to me? When I am afraid, I will put my trust in him. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? You know where he writes those kind of psalms? Hiding in a cave. Think of it. Fleeing from Saul. Prudence. Wisdom. Hiding. Not afraid. You hear it? So I'll just leave that there. You can think more on that. I want to press on here to the second example. So the hiding of Moses. Number two, the choosing by Moses. A costly faith. The choosing by Moses. Verse 24 now. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up. So verse 23 is when he was born, his parents' faith. Now, Moses, when he had grown up. So he's describing Moses' act of faith at his maturity, his own decision. So kids, I know there's kids in here this morning. Thank you for being in here. And kids, you are probably here this morning because your parents are here, right? Your parents brought you, which is a good thing. Don't resent that. Say, thank you, Mom and Dad, for bringing me. You're here. Your faith, right, is based a lot on your parents' faith this morning, as it should be. That's a good thing. But listen, kids, there's coming a time, there's going to be a time in your life when you must choose. Will I follow Christ? My faith. Will I follow Christ? Will I make that decision for Christ? Not because of my parents, because I love Jesus. I want to follow Jesus. That's what Moses had to do, right? So that's what he's talking about. Moses had to do that, kids. It's like we have to do that. Now Moses, while he was nurtured for a time by his biological mom, was adopted into the court of Pharaoh and was raised in the Egyptian court. Can you imagine? So he didn't have all the advantages you do of faith. He had other advantages of power and wealth and pleasure. But there came a time when he has to decide, who am I? Who am I? And that's what he's describing here. He's describing his deliberate choosing, his deliberate choice. Now, what does he have in view? What event? How does he know this? How does our author know that when Moses had grown up that he did this? Well, the event I think he has in mind is Exodus 2, 11 through 15, where Moses, I think, comes out of that palace that he's grown up in, and he identifies with it. He sees his brothers and sisters suffering under the lash, slavery, and he chooses at that point, I'm identifying with them against Egypt. It's where he kills the Egyptian taskmaster. Now, we can debate the justice of what he did there, but what our author is going at is what drove that decision. Do you understand what's behind that action of Moses? It is this faith. So notice what he does. Verse 24, he gives the choice he made. Verse 25, he describes the nature of that choice. Verse 26, he gives the reason for the choice. So just like that, A, B, C. So let's look at them, A, B, C. A deliberate choice. A deliberate choice. Moses made a definitive rejection of Egyptian privilege and identity. Moses made a definitive rejection of Egyptian privilege and identity. Do you see it, verse 24? By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused. You could translate it, renounced being called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. When he, at this point, he's renouncing Egyptian privilege and identity. Now remember, Moses is brought up humanly with every advantage, every privilege in the court, education, power, unlimited resources. He must, though, decide who he is. Who he is. And it's, listen, it's not just ethnically. Like, am I Egyptian or am I Jewish? That's not it. Am I part of the unbelieving God enemy world? Is that what Egypt stands for at this point? Those who oppose to God. You can see it in the Pharaoh. Or do I choose God's people? That's the choice. And that's what he's making. He is choosing God's people to be part of God's people. He has to decide that. This is not just an ungratefulness for his adoption. That's not what's going on here. This is choosing to be part of God's people or part of those who oppose God's people. Right? So this is an act of faith. And again, for our author, remember, he's just pressing this home to us. This is the faith we imitate, because today, following Christ will always involve renouncing the unbelieving world. It just will. That's what Jesus said. If you want to follow me, take up your cross, die to self, be hated by others, follow me. It will involve a renouncing of the unbelieving world. That's what Egypt represents at this stage in the life of Moses. And it is a deliberate choice, isn't it, to follow Christ. It's not indecisive. It's not just adding Jesus onto your unbelieving lifestyle. It is radical. Counting the cost, renouncing unbelief, unbelieving world and its values for Christ and his people. So I just exhort you this morning, if you're here and you're kind of dangling between two opinions, that's what Elijah told the people on Mount Carmel. Stop dangling between two things. If you got one foot like in the church, one foot firmly in the world, you need to choose today. Choose Christ. Renounce the world, the unbelieving world. So we see A, a deliberate choice, B, a costly choice. I said this is a costly faith, a costly choice. So verse 25, he gives the nature of this choice. Moses, on the one hand, renounced being called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He renounced that Egyptian privilege. But what did he choose? Well, he chose, it says, rather to endure ill treatment or to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. So Moses chose to identify with God's people in their sufferings rather than enjoy the temporary advantage of Egypt. Moses chose to identify with God's people in their sufferings rather than enjoy the temporary advantage of Egypt. Don't miss that, verse 25. He chose, again, this is decisive, he chose to share ill treatment with the people of God. You hear it? He is identifying with God's people. That's what he understands. Egypt, not God's people. The enemies of God. I'm choosing to identify with the people of God. Now, this is the first time in these examples that our author can highlight that aspect of faith. Because now you have a people of God in the Old Testament. So faith, this kind of faith that he's describing, is true of those who identify with God's people. True of those who live by faith today. When you choose Christ, he chooses people. The church, you are identifying. It's not just personal, you and Christ. It is, yes, you and Christ and his people. You identify. That's what he's doing. He's identifying. But notice what he's identifying with. He's identifying with the suffering, the ill treatment with his people. Because that's the mark of God's people in an unbelieving world. Ill treatment. Being maligned. That's what marks God's people in the world all through history until Jesus comes. So when you choose God's people, you're choosing some level of ill treatment with God's people. You hear that? Now, if there was ever a person who at great cost identified with the people of God, it was Moses, who left every advantage for the suffering people of God. He'd left so much advantage humanly, and it would cost him. Because after his public act of identification, what happens? 40 years of exile in Midian. And then he's going to return as a Hebrew with God's people, and he's going to live out his days in the wilderness and die. That's a cost. It's a costly faith, right? It's a costly choice. So I'll say again, following Christ will cost you. It will cost you. Take up your cross and die to self. It may include opposition, like it did overtly for Moses and for God's people there. But so many other costs are potential. It may cost your reputation. I said earlier that maybe for the first time in our country's history, identifying as a Christian, the people of God, is not a positive thing. It's a social negative now. The unbelieving world hates our values and morals, doesn't laud them anymore. So there's a cost. It may cost your reputation. It may cost friends, your associations. It may cost family, Jesus said. It may cost finances. It may cause advancement or achievements. What's the cost? Jesus said, before you follow me, I want you to count the cost of what it means to follow me. And it will certainly cost sinful practices. Sinful practices. So notice how he says it, how strikingly he says it there in verse 25. He chose to suffer ill treatment with the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. What a description. The passing pleasures of sin. Now, at one level, that's true of all sin. Sin at the surface is attractive. It holds out pleasure. Pleasures, even abundant pleasures and enjoyments, but in the end is temporary, unsatisfying, and leads to death. The passing pleasures of sin. He chose identify with suffering God's people rather than enjoyment of the passing pleasures of sin. What did it mean for Moses? Now, he's phrasing it this way to identify again with us, whatever that allurement to the world might be. But what did it mean for Moses? Well, for Moses, it meant, right, using the advantage he had with Egypt to avoid the people of God. And no doubt, that advantage had much more pleasure than suffering with the people of God. So for Moses, the sin, what do you mean sin? Well, it's what would keep him from identifying with God's people. And that's what he's after here again in this letter. What would cause us to turn away from Christ? What would cause us to sever relationship with Christ? That's the sin that allures. And so again, this example of Moses is that both the opposition from the world and the allurements of the world threaten our faith. But Moses chose God's people. Leads to see, last one, a reasonable choice. A reasonable choice. Verse 26, he gives the reason. Why would he make what appears to be a very silly, foolish choice, giving up all that Egypt had for suffering? I mean, think of it this way. He chose abuse instead of enjoyment. Who does that? Well, Moses did, and we do. Why? It's the reason. So it says in verse 26, he considered. He reckoned, it's the word. That is, he accurately calculated. Same word he used of Sarah. She considered that God was faithful. It's like Abraham. He considered that God is able to raise the dead. It appeals to a sense of what is reasonable. But listen, this reason only makes sense by faith. This calculation has faith in it. That's the only way this calculus works. By faith. Here's what he reckoned. Moses reckoned that the reproach of Christ was vastly superior to all that Egypt had to offer. He reckoned that the reproach of Christ vastly superior to all that Egypt had to offer. See the language there? It's really striking. He considered the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Now, the treasures of Egypt were world famous. What they had, their treasures, their riches, their opulence. He considered, listen to it, the reproach of Christ. The reproach is just a word that means abuse or slander or disgrace, we might say, insult. The insult, disgrace of Christ, greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Why do you do that? Again, striking that he calls it the reproach of Christ. Do you hear that? He could have just said again in verse 26 that he considered the ill treatment of God's people greater riches, but he's bringing it home to us and to the reader here. Ultimately, it's the reproach of Christ that he is choosing. That's more valuable. Now, again, that's a strange calculation. Was the reproach of Christ greater than all the treasures of Egypt? This reproach of Christ, the suffering in connection with Christ, is the mark of all those who will inherit the reward that he's going to get to here. That's why it's greater. So why say the reproach of Christ? Because he knows. He's, again, we've been seeing this the whole Bible. Those who identify with God's people identify with Christ and his sufferings. Don't you? And it's Christ's sufferings. That's the means by which any of us reach the reward, including Moses or Abraham. It's the same reproach. The reproach Christ endured for us is the reproach we endure when we identify with him. Moses is identifying with Christ in his sufferings. That's what he's doing. Moses knew. Remember, Moses is the one who points us forward to Christ. We'll see more of that next time. Moses knew that by his sufferings, he identified with the Christ to come, with the promised one to come. So sign me up, because those are the sufferings of Christ. I identify with Christ. There's no greater riches than that. And that's what he's exhorting us to do. And the reason there's no greater riches than to identify with the sufferings of Christ is because those sufferings is what leads to glory, right? We share in the sufferings of Christ. We will share in the glories to follow. Paul says, if I'm conformed to his suffering, his death, I will be conformed to his resurrection. So that's greater riches. One last thing. Moses made and continued this decision by constantly looking toward the reward. That's what comes after the sufferings or the reproach of Christ, the reward. Do you see the last phrase there? How did he endure? How did he make this choice and be sustained in this choice? Right there, the last phrase, for he was looking, the tense of the verb, he was continually looking to the reward. That's how. And this brings us back to really the whole point of this chapter. Things hoped for. What all of these examples have in common is that they're looking toward the reward. Abraham was looking to the city that has foundations. They were looking to the promise. So Moses is looking toward the reward, which is, in the end, so vastly superior to all that Egypt could offer. Have you made this choice this morning? This choice to follow Christ. It's a deliberate choice. It's decisive. It's costly. We don't sugarcoat that. And it's reasonable. It's the greatest choice for what it holds. Have you? Don't trade away this future for the passing pleasures of sin, this world. Jim Elliot said it well. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Jesus said it like this: what will a man give in exchange for his soul? What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul? That's a really poor choice, a poor trade. Have you made this choice? Oh, Christian, embrace for opposition as you follow Christ, bear his reproach. Let me end just now. I need to end just with the words of Hebrews itself, chapter 13. I'll put them on the screen, or you can turn there, chapter 13, because the writer is the end of the book. Who knows when we'll get to chapter 13, but let me say it now, because he's going to tie this up, and listen to it. Therefore, Jesus, this is verse 12, therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Hence, let us go to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the city which is to come. Oh, may that be our faith this morning. Let me pray for us, and we'll pick up, Lord willing, with the next examples of Moses next week. Father, may we imitate this courageous faith, both of Moses' parents and of Moses himself. Oh, Holy Spirit, grant us courage in the face of opposition, in the face of fear. May we cling to the promise and constantly look toward the reward that is ours in Christ. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.